for listening to Food And, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Nema Siobhata. As students, we examine and explore our foodways through our senses, literature, history, anthropology, economics, and politics. What impacts our foodways most is climate change, severe droughts, wildfires, devastating storms, and other disastrous weather events are disrupting food supply chains and affecting communities around the world. Ecologically conscious chefs and restaurants are combating this crisis with their sustainable practices and sourcing carbon neutral ingredients in hope of reducing the impact of climate change. This leads us to our special guest, Eric Oberholzer, co-founder of Tender Greens in Los Angeles, board member of the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania, and an advocate for agro biodiversity worldwide with the Food Forever initiative run by the Crop Trust. In your recent Rolling Stone article, you penned a hopeful yet pragmatic guide for enterprising food entrepreneurs in a post-pandemic world, comparing this period to the economic rebound and recovery after World War I. Can you walk us through the five elements you recognize that food entrepreneurs need to consider in this brave new world? Also, amid a surge in Delta variant cases and vaccine mandates, have your views changed since then?
Yeah, I think with that article, what I probably pointed to was, first the three whys. So why does the world need your product or service? Why now? Why is now the best time? And most importantly, why are you and your team the best to bring it to market and execute? And those three whys sort of prompt the entrepreneur to really dig into not just their aspirational visions, but their core competency and also the understanding, the read on the market as it is, and whether or not they're gonna hit the wave when it's cresting and catch it or just totally wipe out. I think this is a very, very interesting time. And the point of the article was in the face of adversity, at a time when people are uncertain and scrambling, it creates huge opportunity to see through the mist and find, find the sunshine. And I think for those who have the vision, the tenacity, the strength, the capabilities to push through some of this fog with absolute razor focus, they can be part of the new class coming out of COVID and into a very innovative market. I think that Delta has complicated things. When I wrote that, I was somewhat, I don't want to say dismissive, but I didn't. I believed that the vaccination rates would be much more robust, and that we would put this all behind us and have a bit more, clear road. Delta is still creating a lot of uncertainty. It's also continuing to deepen the political tension in the country and further. And it's challenging a lot of folks in our space, in hospitality. But, the great advantage of being in food is that people always need to eat. It was one of the reasons that I got into food in the beginning. One was passion, but two was the understanding that it was one of those things that we all needed. And you could navigate real time to the needs versus commit to a lane that might get washed out sometime in the future. So I think for those who are adaptable or just getting started, this is still a very, very interesting and promising time.
You mentioned new technologies can disrupt our food systems by creating transparency. For example, blockchain technology, a cybersecurity system utilized in China's rural agriculture, that Xiaowei Wang writes about in Block Chicken Farm. How do you foresee smart technologies like blockchain advancing our food systems? And what are the factors that are slowing progress here in the US?
I've seen blockchain for 5 years now as one of the answers to absolute transparency that is easy and digestible for everybody along the value chain. It's been slow development in the same way that the internet, when I was in San Francisco in 1992, 93, most of us just had dial-up. Many of us had computers that didn't have modems to even accommodate that dial-up. And the internet was this thing, kind of like Bitcoin and Ethereum, that some people were really excited about, but we couldn't get our heads around entirely. We now understand how important the internet was, right? And we can't imagine a world without it. I believe that blockchain is as big as the internet. And I can't explain that from a technical perspective, but I can from a use case perspective. And as this technology becomes easier for everyday consumers and users to access, I think one of the big areas of opportunity is in supply chain transparency. That's important because without that transparency, brands and companies can say anything, and they can misrepresent their actions with wordsmithing and marketing campaigns and sleight of hands, which confuses the market, confuses the consumers, and creates or maintains this binary belief system of either it's absolutely pure, which almost nobody is, or it's absolutely destructive and dangerous, which few things are as bad as maybe we make them out to be. And the truth is in the continuum between those extremes. And it's with blockchain and other technologies that will be able to assign credit to those who are on various ends of the spectrum, but also in the middle, and bring the consumer into that so they can vote with real understanding and clarity as to who they're supporting. But it has to be user-friendly, because most people don't have the bandwidth to do the deep dive into the products and services that they use. So I think that's really important. And there are a lot of smart people working on this, and a lot of folks on the, as end users who are waiting patiently to pilot it. So I think it's coming. And it won't come overnight, but there'll be some breakout brands or technologies or services that bring it into the mainstream. Beyond that technology, I was just at the Rodale Institute, and they're working with drone technology, robots, lasers that can identify the weeds and then zap them with high voltage. And then they're studying one, the impact on the weeds, but also the impact on those organisms in the soil and above that they don't want to affect the health. So it's being studied, but what was really interesting and promising is that Rodale is going beyond tractors and getting into robotics and some of these high tech systems.
You're listening to Food And, a podcast from the gastronomy program at Boston University Metropolitan College.
Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events in food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
Taranga chef and author of the Forneo cookbook, An Ancient Grain Rediscovered, Pierre Thiam says, today's food system is limiting our global diet to four major crops, corn, rice, soy, and potatoes. This limited diet is affecting both our planet and our health. In the kitchen, chefs are combating climate change through biodiversity by offering underutilized crops on their menus. For example, millet, amaranth, and Forneo that are drought-resistant, versatile, nutritious, and delicious. In your opinion, can chefs expand diners' palates to support these ancient grains? And in what other ways can home cooks combat climate change in their kitchens?
Yeah, good question. A big fan of Pierre, big fan of Forneo. So I think you can look at it two ways. There is biodiversity within an ingredient. So you might have corn, one of the four big commodity monocropped crops on that list. And within corn, you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of variations, different heirloom varieties that have been saved over time that have different attributes and values, both on the grow side in terms of where they thrive, and on the culinary side, as to whether they're best for a polenta or grits or fresh corn or flour or whatever, or animal feed. You know, everybody now knows what heirloom tomatoes are. Well, every ingredient has some long list of heirloom varietals, varietals that have evolved over time, been saved and passed on generation to generation, tribe to tribe, et cetera. And chefs have always leveraged that because each one has its own identity, flavor profile, texture, color. And then you can go wide, as Pierre was suggesting, beyond the four ingredients or, the clean, the dirty dozen and the clean 15, let's say, and into some of these more obscure ingredients that are known in microeconomies. So Forneo in Western Africa, amaranth in Mexico, everybody knows quinoa now, but quinoa in Peru. And there are these amazing crops that are really, really important, both culturally, culinarily, and ecologically to certain regions of the world. And if, as chefs, we can celebrate those, one for their culinary application, two, the novelty to bring new flavors and products to market to consumers, but also to support those unique growing regions where these crops thrive so that they can continue cultivating, let's say, Forneo versus planting genetically modified corn or wheat or something that maybe is not fully optimized, both for the community, for the culture, for the diet, and most importantly for the history of these folks. So chefs absolutely can and must, I think, support both the deepening of their celebration of heirloom varietals, and then the range of all the ingredients on the planet, so that we're using a little bit of everything, not too much of any one thing. And that just has incredible health implications, both to planet and people as well, when you have this diversity of nutrition coming from different forms, you really spread out the nutrition versus concentrating in a way that you're getting too much, even too much of a good thing.
Restaurants that put climate change on the menu don't always find success. For instance, the Washington Post reported the Perennial in San Francisco closed in February of 2019 after 3 years trying to tackle climate change through hyperlocal sourcing, energy efficiency, an eco-conscious design, food waste prevention, and consumer education. Certainly, other factors contribute to any restaurant's closing. But does that occurrence deter restaurateurs from feeding their potential diners the facts about climate change?
Yeah, I think you need to meet people where they're at. So Perennial ought to be celebrated for its efforts, but also a word to the wise about absolutism or purity. And I would say the same thing about, you know, and this is different, but similar, you know, what Daniel Patterson and Roy Choi attempted to do with Local. Worth celebrating, but also worth the case study on why it didn't work. A group like Perennial or Cafe Gratitude might run into some limitations because they're so restrictive and they're so pure, let's say. And while that can be a differentiator, if you don't have enough of an audience to support it, then it doesn't, you know, it ultimately doesn't work. I've actually never been to Perennial. I've tracked it for years and I know it, but I think, you know, at the end of the day, you also have to execute. So is it delicious? Is it craveable to people? Is it within their budget? You know, there are a lot of components from a business sense that need to be right to support, you know, the higher mission. I think it's so important for us not to exist in this or get caught up in the binary that you're either Perennial or you're McDonald's. It's better to do 10% of what Perennial was attempting to do and thrive than do 70% of it and maybe fall out of economic favor. So doing a little bit and being honest about it and saying, you know, here's what we're committed to, here's what we can be most impactful with and still be a viable business, and we have this long-term pathway towards better. So next year we'll bump it up to 20% and then, you know, 30%. And over a decade, we might get pretty close to where Perennial wanted to be, and we'll have time to bring a broader audience with us. Whereas a Perennial might automatically shut too many people out of the experience, whether because they look at it and say it's too expensive, it's too judgmental, and I feel uncomfortable, whatever, you know, and I'd have to look at the reasons why they, you know, they closed, but you definitely don't pull the plug on it and say, okay, it's not, consumers don't care, we shouldn't do it. We should absolutely do as much as we possibly can and then stretch it a little bit more because it's the right thing to do. But we can't stretch things to the point where we're not a viable business. And I think the gold standard is still Chez Panisse after all these years. She's been at this for 50 years and very successful. So I think as many Perennials as there may be, there's still Chez Panisse.
Thank you for listening to Food And. You can learn more about our guests on our blog at sites.bu.edu/gastronomy.
Connect with new friends and get updates on new events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
Activists and students are at the front lines in combating the climate crisis. Many protests and campaigns are led by environmental groups that are fed up with the response of governments debating climate change. At BU, the gastronomy program offers courses discussing sustainable food systems, food policies, and food waste. Does climate change need to be part of the curriculum in other culinary programs across campuses at different levels to study the impact of climate change and reach a consensus towards actual resolutions?
Well, I think in the scientific community, the consensus is clear. So the science is in. I don't know that we need any more doctoral thesis on the impact of the food system on climate change or energy. The rest is all politicized, and I wouldn't get too dragged into that. It's relevant, but I wouldn't get too dragged into it. I think the question for, you know, for those who want to take action, at what levels are we going to be most impactful? So you're always going to have the activists like Greenpeace and Sea Shepherd and Patagonia Provisions, et cetera, Rodale, Crop Trust, who are really driving an agenda at global levels, at global policy levels in the United Nations and what have you. And you will always need those groups. But I think what is important is entrepreneurs, whether they're food entrepreneurs or fashion entrepreneurs or whoever, absolutely must understand that their supply chain choices matter. And it to some degree, it matters to consumers, but you have to get credit for it. And you have to find ways to connect with consumers in micro doses. But I think more importantly, we have to get entrepreneurs to understand that whether people are looking or not, here are the behaviors that are going to shape a world and a planet that we want to live in. And here are the ones that historically are causing the problems. Again, it's not a do it or don't do it scenario. There's a whole menu. As long as you know that menu and you can begin to chip away at it, then you're doing something. Chefs, CPG companies, big food, whatever, all need to be super engaged and clear about what matters to them and within the framework of their business, what they can do. I say this with a stretch. So not the easy button, but a stretch that there's some pain, there's some leadership, there's some gumption in it, because going about this all casually isn't going to get us to where we need to be.
Before our last question, if you were to design a menu to teach awareness of the climate crisis, what would you serve and whom would you invite to the table?
Well, I would source everything from my property. And if I couldn't grow it or catch it or find it here, I'd be able to walk to a neighboring farm and get it. And what that would address, and this is the whole idea of local food or farm to fork, I'm serving what is freshest. There's zero carbon footprint. As a matter of fact, it might be carbon negative because there's some sequestration on the, on the farm. And I would, if appropriate, and if I could, before that meal, I would invite the guests to walk and see where their food came from. Meet the chickens in a very Portlandia way, although they wouldn't have to get in the car and drive because their chickens might come to them. We might walk into the forest and see what the forest is giving us, and down to the pond to see what that has offered. And then the garden or the pastures to pick berries so that there's a deep connection. And in that meadow report, as we call it here, we'd also point out what's happening around the plants, whether it's the hummingbird or the butterflies, or what somebody might view as a weed is actually really important for the diversity of the property. It's poisonous to the animals and to us, but it's important still. And why, that's an example of diversity on the property, or erosion control, or whatever it may be. I would invite the CEO of Monsanto, and the reason for that is, if I were to invite all the people that I would normally want here, then I'd have Alice Waters and Dan Barber and all these cool people who we could completely geek out. but I'm not changing anything. I might learn something from them, but I'm not really changing anything. But if I get the CEO of you know, the company that is on the other side of this conversation to see it through my lens, not in a judgmental way, not in a threatening way, but just as an invitation to understand and maybe find some commonality and overlaps. I might just find that that person is professionally charged with shareholder value and growth, but agrees with us in his personal view. And that would be an opportunity to take some of that personal perspective and seed the culture of Monsanto. And again, you only have to change a few percentage points with a company like Monsanto to make a massive difference. There's not much you can change at Chippenese or Stone Barns. So I'm a big believer in finding pathways to collaboration, to even with those who might appear as the enemy or the antithesis of what we believe in.
Around the globe, we're witnessing more climate crisis, weather events that are affecting critical food systems, from floods and hurricanes to droughts and wildfires. Furthermore, the pandemic has impacted food supply chains, from underemployment in distribution and food processing to depleting resources for food industry operations. However, some chefs and restaurants are responding to this sense of urgency around the climate crisis. For example, Zero Footprint, founded by Anthony Myant and Karen Leibowitz, that provide resources for carbon neutral restaurants. What would you say is needed from cooks and chefs in the present and in the future to combat the climate crisis?
Well, I think Zero Footprint is a great start, because it brings awareness to those who are signed on and dedicated to doing more. And it pressures peers to do the same. So it's a little bit like a lead in that sense. I think the key is a continued sensitivity and dedication to local. A visibility to those in the supply chain that grow or produce something very unique to a part of the world that we can't replicate, can only be brought in. It might, you know, I have somebody down in Colombia right now who's studying vanilla, for example. You know, there might be some agroforestry efforts by indigenous tribes high up in the Sierra Madre Mountains that, you know, our support will help them continue to an effort to reforest sort of sacred land. So I think those connections, both globally and hyper-locally, are really important. An avoidance of any sort of ingredients that are not in season, you know, berries in January don't make any sense. And then I think we have to, you know, on the zero waste side of things, we have to commit to reducing waste. And that's not, you know, it's not just composting, but it's menu design, it's collaboration with our farmers. There's this brilliant photograph. I was at Google and they showed this split screen in Watsonville, and it was a romaine field. And on one side there was a tractor, and on another side it was just open field. Both fields almost looked identical, and yet one had just been harvested. So the point was, though this field on the left had just been harvested, only the romaine hearts had been harvested, leaving 50% of the edible plant in the ground. So that's in a place like Watsonville, where you have intense challenges with water, That's water waste, it's resource waste, it's misuse of the soil. So all those nutrients that are pulled out of the soil for that plant, yeah, they might get tilled back in, which disrupts the soil, but they're not used to go anywhere, and they could be going to school systems and whatever. And the question to all of us was, when did romaine hearts become acceptable? And I remember it. I remember when romaine hearts became the thing, and chef's responsibility to now turn that around again and say, you know what, we're going to use, you know, the entire lettuce, or we might just use the outer lettuce and let the, you know, the hearts go to hotels and whoever, you know, they can go to Vegas. But we use our platform, we use our voice in an aggregated or cohesive form to build movement and density and volume and scale in these areas where we want to see change, and then pressure, you know, urban and rural infrastructure to support this. You know, San Francisco is good, Los Angeles isn't. You know, it doesn't have a robust centralized composting system, so it makes it very hard to compost. Boston, where you go to school, a friend of mine who owns a few vegan restaurants up there followed the recycling truck out of the city and found that he wasn't going to a recycling center. They were just going to the dump. I think public-private partnerships, transparency, honesty, and a cohesive, holistic solution through infrastructure and behavior on some of these big things is necessary. And right now we're a bit fractured. We have to make it easy for people to do good for the environment. And if we make it hard, then they're just not going to do it.
Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
I want to thank our guest, Eric Oberholzer, for joining us in this episode of Food And, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Nema Siobhata, signing off.